And hello, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
I feel like we should have more people in the studio for this review.
Maybe 75 more people?
At least. Plus cameos. we'll persevere. Maybe it won't feel as crowded, and maybe it'll feel like we can actually tell the story.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new superhero magnum opus, Avengers Infinity War. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news from the past week, including John Lasseter. His was one of the, let's say, low-key Me Too stories last fall, but his sabbatical is almost up, sabbatical in quote marks, and is it time for another would-be Predators to start testing the waters for a comeback? And then we're going to talk about the next Star Trek movie. Yes, things are in motion for the next Star Trek adventure, including that Tarantino movie we've talked about before on the show. And are we maybe even getting some more Star Trek movies? We hope so. We're Trekkies here. But first, you have probably heard about this group called Nexium, or as it's spelled, N-X-I-V-M, which, you know, it seems like it should be a running shoe or something, or... one of those pills that's advertised on CNN every hour on the hour. Get Nexium and may cause thrombophlebitis. I don't know.
That's a made-up word.
What, Nexium or thrombophlebitis?
Well, both of them, really.
Fair enough. The reason why this is kind of in our wheelhouse is because the second-in-command who was arrested was Allison Mack, who most people probably remember as... you were a Smallville fan, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so was I.
Yeah.
She played Chloe, Clark Kent's newspaper girl Friday friend on Smallville for 10 years. And you know what? Just like from the pure pop culture perspective, mm-hmm. if someone had said to me like Sam Jones III had been like involved in a sex cult,
that would have made more sense to you?
I would have not been as surprised, because like, yeah. Well, how else has he been earning a living all this time? But, you know, Allison Mack, she did all 10 years on that show. It's like, yeah. She's got to have some bank.
Well, not only that, then she also did however many years of you know...
Oh, the Elijah Wood
talking
to... All the
appearances, too.
Yeah. Like... Oh, I thought you were going to say the Elijah Wood... Talks to a Dog show. I can't remember that name. She was on that too.
Elijah Wood Talks to a Dog. I try to avoid things with Elijah Wood in it, so I missed that one, obviously. Yeah, you know, it's funny. So, not so much on the surprise scale of like who from that show is still making money, but more the, you know, it's so
icky.
Clear. It is icky. And it's one of those things where it's just like, oh, yeah, when it's someone that you think you like or that you think you know,
yeah.
It's like, oh, this is weird. And, you know, at first you want to start making excuses like, well, no, just, you know, but that's just not the case. Well, yeah. To be fair, luckily, I already had a heads up on this. So when it came out and I said, oh, so they've finally really like moved on this cult, because I did know that she was part of a cult.
Yeah.
Not to what extent the weirdness around it was. And I also knew that Kristen Kruick was actually sort of the person who introduced her to this cult.
Yes, Kristen Kruick, who is another star of Smallville.
Yeah.
Or Edgemont, if you're like a fan of like early 2000s CBC TV.
Or that Beast show on TV.
The Beauty and the Beast.
Is that what it's?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's come and gone.
Yeah. But yeah, so...
Good like, for her. She's successful. Yeah. She didn't need this cult nonsense.
Yeah. But so I definitely, like I did, and it's probably been, I don't exactly remember how long, but I feel like it's been a few months now mm-hmm. since I did hear, whether it was through some, you know, podcast or entertainment site talking about how, you know, what are the stars of Smallville doing nowadays? And
oh,
just
I hate
like,
those.
Yeah. But, you know, it was low-key news, but it was news already that, you know, Kristen Kruick had gone to this. As, to be fair, as many, especially young actors, go to try to figure, you know, find some grounding, right? It's mm-hmm. just like one day I was just... whatever, trying to like do a Noxzema commercial, and suddenly now I am in this like superstar TV show, and people are sending me fan letters, and everybody wants a piece of me. And so it's difficult. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me when people from shows like this just suddenly go, I need to find something to put me back on track, because life is spinning out of control. And then they get taken advantage of. This is not me making excuses for Allison Mack whatsoever. Right. But it is how I see people get there to begin with. And then eventually they either break from it, or they become victims of it. Or apparently, if you're Allison Mack, you just go, great, now I've found the ticket. I will, like, she seems to be, I don't know, right in there.
She's definitely in the thick, and, you know, because the report is like she's basically second in command of that thing.
Yeah.
And there's been some good reporting in Vanity Fair about all the people, famous people she was sending like emails to, mm-hmm. and tweets like, hey, you know, so and so, Emma Watson was one of them.
Yeah.
Like, hey, like, talk to me about, you know, like getting good executive, like, this is the kind of hook and line. It was like this kind of executive course, these kind of like positive thinking seminars to, you know, to juice you up and get you into like the right headspace to follow your dreams and all that sort of thing. It reminds me too of, and you saw Going Clear.
No,
you haven't seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Because there's an interview with the woman who was like John Travolta's like Scientology manager in the 70s. Mm-hmm. She got out.
Yeah.
But she was talking about, you know, for actors, the message of Scientology was very appealing because you're going out to auditions all day, you're dealing with rejection all day, and then you come to this place where it's like, oh, you're great the way you are, and like, let's work on your, you know, positivity, and let's make you a better person, and let's go out and do great things. And so, you know, actors being understandably fairly egocentric.
And with the lowest self-esteem.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know how those things go together, but it does. Yeah.
But to your other point about how this is something that's been on the radar, of certain people, like, there's like reports, and again going back to Vanity Fair in 2010, of the two sisters who were kind of the original victims of this, the Bronfmans.
Oh yes,
Claire and Sarah Bronfman, who were heirs to the Seagram's liquor fortune.
Yep.
And their father's a kind of a well-known philanthropist now, and apparently they've sunk like $150 million into this guy. We should name him Keith Rennie, a.k.a. The Vanguard. Which is
that's just, you know, when people start taking on these ridiculous titles, it's just like, I think this is not where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah, it's not only a goofy title, but it has like, there's something very Nazi-ish about it. It's like, hello, I'm the Vanguard.
Well, and isn't the Vanguard supposed to be like more than one person?
Yeah, it's a group. You're right. It's it's supposed to be, we are the Vanguard.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. But so I guess he's like Legion, because he's
I hope he's not Legion. He sounds
the frig
gross.
Knows? Yeah.
And hi, thanks for like making a run for it and going to another country and leaving your second in command to take all the...
That was particularly
again,
gross.
Again, not that this is excusing or, you know, letting Allison Mack off the hook, but
no,
it's weird and it's difficult to, you know, like, it's one of those times you have to remember, right, the person portraying a role is not the role.
No.
Because, like, Chloe Sullivan, I think, you know, arguably she sort of started as a bit of a Mary Sue. She was kind of the person that everyone was like, oh yeah, that would be me if I was in this situation. But became like this super incredible character, so much so that actual comic book wrote her into canon. Like, she was not part of the
That's right.
myth at all.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh right, just because you played this role does not make you remotely like this person.
It's not even just that. It's, you know, I think a case could be made to an extent that, you know, people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta, being so deep in Scientology for years, are victims of it, even though, you know, Tom Cruise gets incredible benefits from being in Scientology. Mm-hmm. But she was actually, Allison Mack, actively recruiting people and, you know, she understood that she was leading young women to become sex slaves, that there was human trafficking afoot, that it went so far as him, Keith Raniere, branding people with a symbol that is basically his initials. Wacky coincidence. So it's like one step away, like since it's not transactional in terms of money, it's like that one step away from being actual slavery. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, that's where the inexcusableness comes from, because she was at the top. I mean, Tom Cruise is like a mascot, but she was actually leading the charge.
Yeah, so she certainly doesn't seem like a brainwashed member of the cult. She is one of the brainwashers.
Yeah. And it's sad, but it's also sad that, I mean, we're kind of talking about this cult now. Scientology is going on its
merry way.
Well, it's going on its merry way, but it doesn't feel as invincible as it once did. Mm-hmm. But I mean, how many other Nexiums are out there and that are not going noticed? And you know, it's a real thing. Cults are still a real thing. That's. Mm-hmm. People think maybe it's passé, or that this is like a, you know, or if it doesn't get to Jonestown levels, you know, let people go about, you know, their business, handing out leaflets or whatever it is. But, you know, I don't think this is an isolated case, and it should, you know, because of the salaciousness of it and the celebrity factor of it, it should serve as kind of a greater lesson that, you know, there are people out there who want to take advantage.
And not only that, there are people out there who will continue to make entertainment out of people's lives, which just leads those people to be closer to a place where they need a cult. Not that it's a cult when they, you know, sort of get involved, but they need something, and that's how they end up being part of a cult.
Right. Self-care. That was depressing.
Yeah, let's move on to the super exciting, not depressing, Me Too stuff.
Yeah, yeah. This was in the Hollywood Reporter, but John Lasseter, I had forgotten he was actually caught up in the Me Too dragnet.
I had as well, but to be fair, even in the article that I was reading, it did sort of, you know, talk about how it was kind of under the radar, because it really was. It was just sort of a quiet, like, I'm just going to take a leave.
Well, oh, I thought you meant like his proclivities, because that does seem, under the radar seems to be how it has always been. But yeah, he took a leave of absence. Again, a sabbatical in quote marks for 6 months. That 6 months is almost up, and they're expecting that he will not actually be returning to Disney and Pixar. He was the chief creative officer for both animation studios. And The Hollywood Reporter piece pointed out that, you know, they again, Pixar had a very good year at the Oscars. Nobody said John Lasseter's name, which is odd because he is the one of the founding fathers of Pixar. You'd think he would get probably an executive producer too. So you think he would get a shout out, but no. So if he were to return to work, he would probably be the first of these people post Weinstein to, you know, come back to their job. And that would be particularly icky for Disney. And the reporter made the note of pointing out Bob Iger, who's the CEO of Disney, is his main area of like management style is to just like keep the peace and not like rock the boat.
Yeah.
So they're talking about how unlikely it is Lasseter would come back. But I mean, it's not the only story this week about the Me Too perpetrators like wanting to make a comeback, because you had Matt Lauer, you know, popping his head out.
And, oh yeah.
There's like rumors of Louis C.K. like showing up at comedy clubs, like not performing but just like hanging out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I am all for men having an opportunity to learn from their mistakes. You know, the only way that we move forward is to call people out on things that are wrong and teach them how to move forward with the right behavior. So I don't think that we should just totally like, you did this once or many time and now you're gone and that's it. We should allow people the opportunity to understand what the nature of their crime was, the impact it had on other people, how not to take part in that behavior again. I don't believe that, you know, a 40, 50, 60-year-old man can unwind 40, 50, 60 years of behavior in 6 months. No. Like, it's just absolutely not possible, no matter how much people try to fix it. And obviously, I don't want to liken sexual misconduct to addiction, because it's not an addiction.
No.
But, you know, people who are addicts, say they remain addicts all their life, they're constantly working to change their behaviors.
You're taught that in AA too.
Yeah, like, this is something that's part of you. It has been part of you. You need to consistently fight against it.
Right.
So 6 months, taking a couple of courses, is not really enough to, to, you know, start fixing behaviors. The one thing I will say on Disney's side, and I think, you know, this is sort of a testament to how we kind of forgot that John Lasseter was part of this, is that they took the right steps, and he wrote his letter, took his leave of absence. They got ahead of it rather than waiting for it to blow up in the media. Internally, they, you know, shook up house a little bit by getting rid of a few people who perhaps had been not perpetrators, but enablers.
Enablers.
They, you know, started doing internally a lot of, you know, workshops and things on the types of behaviors that are and are not allowed, how to spot it, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that they've taken all of the right steps from the organizational point of view. But then now it's the, okay, well, how much of it did they really mean then, if they do let John Lasseter back to work?
Well, it's, I think it's pretty clear. Maybe it's not so clear, because obviously they wouldn't make a big deal about him. Hey, let's welcome back John.
He's
he had a great 6 months, like, exploring his inconsistencies and his fallibilities. We're going to welcome him back. They wouldn't do that, obviously. But at the same time, it's hard to kind of sweep him away, because, you know, he, again, like in sort of like the Harvey Weinstein example, how, you know, people would praise him, and even people he'd victimized would praise him. People have compared Lasseter to Walt Disney himself, in terms of he's the biggest creative force behind Disney since Walt Disney himself. And oddly enough, like Walt Disney, it, you know, there are some dark shadows there. Only except, you know, in 2018, we're kind of want to tolerate that kind of thing. And what was fascinating sort of reading up on this is just realizing how well constructed his image as the jolly guy in the Hawaiian shirt. And like, he's the Pixar guy, and he's created Woody and Buzz and all these like wonderful characters. He's so tuned into the kid's mind, and he's, you know, there are people at Disney he's, you know, shoved out the portal. People like Gil Keane, who was the guy who, I think he drew Ariel in The Little Mermaid and won the Oscar this year for that Kobe Bryant short. And so, you know, definitely one of the preeminent animators of our time. But John Lasseter got rid of him. And there are a lot of people at Disney who he just sort of turned off. And, you know, it goes on in the article about how there were like basically two people who he would listen to. One was a man named Joe Rott, who worked at Pixar's, kind of one of that founding class of Pixar. And the other was Steve Jobs, who bought Pixar from Lucasfilm. Both men, unfortunately, dead. So with them gone, like the protections are gone, plus the cuffs and the restraints are also gone.
Maybe the moral compass. Not that I don't know about the other gentleman, but not the Steve Jobs particularly had his moral compass pointing in the right direction. But perhaps on sexual misconduct, he might have. We don't actually know.
It's certainly no one's come out and said anything of that sort against Steve Jobs since he died. And probably would have come out by now, one would think, given the times and the fact that Steve Jobs can't retaliate, being he is ashes in the wind. It's another reminder. It's just that there's an opportunity here for to come back. And I do find what you said persuasive, that, you know, people should have an opportunity to learn from their mistakes. I'm not sure that would be in the form of being the creative head of Disney Animation again, but, you know, maybe, you know, sitting in a room and listening to people, you know, pitch movie ideas or, you know, doing some behind the scenes. Because I think to go to another one, the Devin Faraci example, mm-hmm. What honked people off wasn't that the Draft House gave him some work to keep him going. What honked people off was that they did it and never said anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, the cover-up is worse than the crime in that instance. So if Disney were to come out and say, you know what, he's done some things and we're going to, like, keep him on retainer as kind of like a consultant or something, while he continues to work through his things, you know, open and honest and transparent like that, that's fine. But when you have, like, Louis C.K. sneaking around clubs, and when you have Charlie Rose, rumor is that somebody's pitching a show with him, and, it, you know, it's like, you know, it's been, what, 6 months?
Yeah.
And these are old guys, too, who are, you know, set in their ways. And it's like, you know, Matt Lauer wasn't, you know, just like going around pinching women on the butt. He was, you know, inviting them into his office, you know, shutting the door with a button under his desk and then dropping his pants. Ugh.
And at no point have these men actually come out and said,
confess,
I understand what the impact of my behavior was.
Yeah. And then and Matt Lauer went full denial this week, too, in a statement. So. Also in a bit of denial, Trek fans, because we had Star Trek Discovery, which I think was a pretty good success. I enjoyed Star Trek Discovery, but we haven't heard much about the movies lately. And this was actually last fall. We talked, not Candace and I, but I think it was when Eliza and Mary from Savvy Spinsters were on. We talked about Quentin Tarantino working on a Star Trek script.
Yes.
But there was the National Association of Theater Owners, which is like a trade show for movie theater owners, and all the studios heads come, and the guy, Jim Giannopoulos, who's the head of Paramount Pictures, which owns the Star Trek franchise, came out and said, we're working on two movies. He didn't say which two, but it's implied that one is the Tarantino one, and the other one is a continuation of the Abrams initiated series, and then they announced that a woman, speaking of Me Too, women finally broke the glass ceiling on Star Trek movies. S.J. Clarkson is going to direct. We don't know what she's going to direct or who she's going to direct it in, because on top of it all, there's no, they had contract for three movies with everybody in that reboot, and nobody knows who will come back, and even one of them can't come back, because it was Elton Yenshin, who is unfortunately passed away in 2016. So, tough.
I feel like Paramount is trying to suck dry every penny they can out of this franchise they own.
They're trying to suck, all right.
Yeah. I think it's definitely time to, I don't know, but move on from the J.J. Abrams sort of Kelvin universe. But I do think Star Trek fans are okay with let's try something different again. You know, there are some things it's like, oh, can we stop rebooting this? Like, we don't need another Spider-Man. Like, how many Spider-Man reboots can we get? But I think Star Trek, you know, there were three movies. One was really great. The first one was like, wow, that was amazing. The second one was awful. And the third one redeemed it a little bit. Yeah. And I think that they can just let it rest there. That will mean maybe not Carl Urban as Leonard McCoy anymore, which I think is the biggest bright spot of that franchise. But so maybe, you know, I would be interested in seeing like a total new take again. I don't know about this Quentin Tarantino thing. I don't know. and sort of swinging back to the Allison Mack thing, right? Again, this is one of those things where I have always held Quentin Tarantino in pretty high esteem as a storyteller and as a director. And Things have come out about him. Yeah. And it's challenging. It's sort of one of those things where I'm like, oh, I completely believe everything she says.
Yeah.
And do I want to celebrate a man who, you know, enables and a little bit terrorizes, you know, bullies through work. I don't know.
Yeah, that's tough. And I have to say, like, the way he's kind of been acting with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like, it's like, I don't know if he's got, like, the second coming of Citizen Kane. It feels kind of like that, or he's, like, controlling, like, every aspect. It's like, okay, studios, you're going to come into a room, you're going to read the script, you're going to have 15 minutes to come up with a pitch. Like, it's like he's running his own personal little reality show.
Matt Damon and Ben Affleck tried that already.
They sure did. They tried it twice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, that I get. I mean, what I find is intriguing is that they would go let somebody like a Tarantino have a crack at this, because mm-hmm. Tarantino isn't going to do stuff. Tarantino isn't going to take studio notes, is what I'm saying.
To begin with, yeah.
So he's going to do what he's going to want. He's going to do what he's going to want to do, and Paramount can either take it or leave it. Fortunately for them, he can't take his Star Trek movie to another studio.
Yeah.
The thing with S.J. Clarkson, and you know, I think when Star Trek Beyond came out, there were rumors that they were going to do for Star Trek IV was going to involve bringing Chris Hemsworth as Captain Kirk's dad mm-hmm. back, which seemed bizarre because now we're doing time travel within the Kelvin universe. It's
time travel trumps everything. You can just throw time travel in, you can make any story you want.
It's like, well, we killed him off. That's what time travel's for.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's I kind of feel like they've run out of ideas mm-hmm. there, which is kind of bizarre because the whole point of rebooting something is to just like open it up to entirely new ideas.
Yeah, they rebooted it and then thought they'd have to retread the whole.
Yeah, well,
yeah, I guess weird. It's
yeah.
Weird.
Well, I mean, Star Trek's kind of been chasing Wrath of Khan since Wrath of Khan came out.
It's perfect movie the way it is. Just leave it. Let it be. Move on.
Yeah.
Make something different.
Yeah. And I wonder now with Discovery, which I think it, you know, is chasing many of the same storylines that Star Trek movie would have chased, and it's sort of the Kelvin universe. Kind of looks like the Kelvin universe because it's sort of taken inspiration from its production design from that. There's kind of like nowhere for it to go because Discovery is covering that mm-hmm. same ground. It's tricky too because of CBS owns the rights to Star Trek on TV and mm-hmm. Paramount owns the rights to Star Trek in the movies, and never the tween shall meet because of politics. Mm-hmm. But it's disappointing because I love Star Trek, and it seems like it's so hard to get a Star Trek movie going now, and it's
luckily, yeah. We have over 40 years of Star Trek to go back to.
Most of it on Netflix. All right, we'll leave it there. That's enough sad stuff. We're going to talk about superheroes and, well, actually, that kind of ended sadly, but we'll get there. since we're talking about Infinity War, we'll open with some Infinity. This is the Double X, and their tune Infinity. So we'll take a musical break and come right back with our review. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos. He's a plague, Tony. He invades planets. He takes what he wants. He wipes out half the population. He sent Loki. The attack on New York. That's him.
This is it. What's our timeline?
No telling. He has the power in space stones. That already makes him the strongest creature in the whole universe. If he gets his hands on all six stones, Tony...
He could destroy life on a scale hitherto undreamt of.
Did you seriously just say hitherto undreamt of?
Are you seriously leaning on the cauldron of the cosmos?
Is that what it is?
I'm going to allow that. If Thanos needs all six, why don't we just stick this one down the garbage disposal? No can do.
We swore an oath to protect the Time Stone with our lives.
And I swore off dairy, but then Ben and Jerry's named a flavor after me, so... Stark raving hazelnuts. Not bad. A bit chalky.
And that was a clip from Avengers Infinity War, the new film from Joe and Anthony Russo, and it stars almost everyone... That's ever been in a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. including in that clip, Mark Ruffalo, Benedict Cumberbatch, Benedict Wong, and Robert Downey Jr. So it's all been leading to this. First of all, I will praise Marvel Studios for doing it. They did it.
Yes, they said they were going to.
Yes.
They put all the pieces in place.
Yes.
And they have executed.
Yes. Having said that, though, I feel like because this is both the plan, they've kind of bastardized what I feel like were the two best Marvel movies of the last few years, which was Thor Ragnarok and Black Panther. Like, the first several minutes of the film basically undo everything with Thor Ragnarok. And then, you know, we did the Black Panther review, and we were saying, like, oh, we hope, like, we knew it was going to be Wakanda was going to be in Avengers. Like, oh, we hope they didn't bastardize Wakanda. And, yeah, Wakanda's basically, like, a set piece.
And it's hard to
blame Marvel because everything they touch turns to gold. But it's, I don't think they understood what a cultural touchstone Black Panther would be. I don't think anybody did. Like the third biggest movie of all time. So I don't think there was an understanding just how huge that movie would be, even in respect to Marvel movies. But having said that, it's still like they watered it down.
Yeah. But I mean, to be fair, I think we all a little bit expected that. I mean, I will. So I have mixed feelings about this film, which is actually good because I went in thinking it was going to be awful. So this is actually a positive review.
Okay.
So I don't think anybody, you know, ever expected all the characters to get all the things that they wanted them to get. And I do think that they did a very good job with such an enormous cast.
Yeah.
By essentially really splitting them up.
Yeah.
They really split them up into a number of different sort of A, B, C, and D storylines, which was good. And I also think that the matchups of who they split up was very well done as well. I was pretty happy with most of the way they split the cast up. So I think that they've, you know, it's an impossible task, really. How do you make a movie, even this one at its 2.5 hour length? You know, there's no, you couldn't push it any further than that for one movie. So how in one movie do you get this many characters and give them not equal time, but give them time that actually moves the plot forward? And I think that they did a pretty good job of that. A surprisingly good job, actually.
It was it's very well constructed, and the Russos, it should not be terribly surprising because it really seems like Civil War was the beta test for this.
Which failed miserably as far as I'm concerned, but I know other people have different opinions on that one.
I think Civil War is very enjoyable, and I think the Captain America trilogy is the one that has like the most obvious arc to it, and sort of pays off in the end it pays off in a way that makes sense where it begins. And I think that's something the Russos did very, very well. But yeah, it's at the same time, though, they are very, like, they're very journeyman. There's nothing like that really they put a stamp on that says this is a Russo brothers film. They are very they're very good at terms of executing the needs of the movie in terms of where it fits in with the greater Marvel oeuvre. And I think where I'm having difficulty is I think Marvel's moved past that as like not just as in terms of the individual movies, but I think as a studio, considering that, you know, they have Ryan Coogler doing Black Panther. They have, you know, James Gunn doing his own thing with the Guardians. Although James Gunn was an exec producer on here, so he might have had some degree of influence in terms of how the Guardians were used. And, you know, it just seems like they were kind of moving away from the we got to set up movies ABC by doing DEF in the Avengers movies or what have you. In much the same way I feel like that Age of Ultron failed. Like, mm-hmm. A lot of Age of Ultron's faults had to do with not the story, and I don't think that I thought Ultron was fine as a villain. I thought everybody in it was great, but it just seemed like
we have to get Vision.
Yeah, we have
How
to
do
get,
we get Vision into this story.
We have to get Vision. We have to set up Wakanda. We have to set up this. we have to set up Infinity Stones because mm-hmm. that's what's coming next. It's too much, and I think. Yeah, there's a part of my mind that's like it pays off well here. Mm-hmm. And as a comic book reader, like one of the things that got me into comic books was the Infinity Gauntlet story. Because I started reading comics about the same time that came out. And I think I started with issue 3, which was the issue where they put together the team to go up against Thanos. And so it's like, hold on, this is a comic with Doctor Strange and Silver Surfer and Cyclops and Wolverine and Captain yeah. America and Hulk and everybody. It's like, oh, cool. That's what comics do. And I guess there's maybe a factor to this as well that people are going to go in and go, cool, it's everybody together.
Yeah.
I guess it's paid off. It's turned out to be bigger than Star Wars The Force Awakens, or mm-hmm. as big in terms of that opening, but just for me, who's someone who's gone along with this, the series as it's unfolded, it's just like the novelty of it is kind of gone. Like,
yeah, so in the new year, or just before the new year, we talked about mm-hmm. Our like weird awards, and one of them was about the thing that I'm just tired of, basically. And I said superhero movies. Like, I'm tired of superhero movies. I'm tired of the same characters. I'm tired of not only that, mostly the zero stakes. Like, it's just, why am I bothering this time when I know that none of the outcomes are actually, like, I already know who's going to live and be in future movies and who's going, like, I know these things.
Yeah.
So at no point do I ever really feel anyone is at risk.
Right.
Which is interesting, of course, with this movie has a bizarre ending. And I think that there were definitely people in the audience who were super confused.
Yes.
Yeah.
I will go further. There were people sitting behind me opening night on Thursday night who were pissed.
Yeah.
They were angry.
Yeah.
At where they're like, it was, I definitely heard a what the F.
Yeah. And I really liked the ending.
I liked the ending too.
The way they executed it was a little maudlin in some places.
It was not, the way it was executed, it was not well, but I thought it was the natural place to end what is a two-parter, and I think maybe a lot of people don't understand it's a two-parter.
And what I wished happened at that point is that had been the end, and I really wanted this film, of all of them, to have no post-credits scene. To really kind of mess with people. Or not so much mess with them, but just to really, for them to people, to still leave the theater with that, what the heck just happened?
Yeah.
I don't understand, because this, that, and the other, these movies are already happening. Like, what happened? And I really wanted it to have no post-credit scene, and unfortunately, I didn't get what I wanted. But at least the post-credit scene didn't particularly answer any questions.
No, I actually heard one person, because sometimes with these post-credit scenes, you're like, what does that mean? Yeah. And I heard somebody say that, what does that mean? And I heard somebody else say, I don't care. It was kind of beautiful.
That's great.
But they should have done it. It felt like that was their instinct, but then had to stick this on.
Yeah.
And then, because after the post-credit scene, what comes up, it says Thanos will return. Usually it says something like the Avengers will return, or Thor will return, or what have you. But this one said Thanos will return. And it kind of adds like this ominous gleam to it. Mm-hmm. Or they could have made the post-credit scene like that scene of Thanos, like, at the end, where he's just sitting there watching, like feeling a sense of accomplishment. It feels like they wanted to go into like a very pessimistic direction with the ending, and they couldn't take it all the way there.
I will say, so one of the failures of this movie, I think, is Thanos. And I think that they did an okay job with him, but I think that they wanted to make him an interesting layered character. They worked really hard at that and spent a lot of airtime on that. And I think that that could have been interesting and could have made me care about him if it had come at any time over the last 10 years rather than just in the 2.5 hours of that film.
Right. It's
right. We're supposed to believe that he actually, that he has feelings, that he's motivated by a deep trauma, that like all these things. I'm like, I could be okay with these things if you had given me any of it.
He's played to begin with. Yeah, he's been played as a boogeyman in the few appearances that he has made thus far. And in here, they try to add some nuance. I appreciate that. And there are they try to build up this relationship between him and Gamora, which I also kind of appreciated, except
it's too little too late.
There's been there's been no kind of hint of that before. And I guess if the Marvel movies were like under the command of sort of one person who was making all the creative decisions for every movie, you might have gotten some hints of that in like Guardians 2 or something, like as a teaser. But it proves kind of the limitation of the extended universe ideal that, you know, James Gunn clearly didn't care about Thanos when he was making Guardians of the Galaxy 2. And because the first Guardians was successful, he was given pretty free reign. No one was saying, hey, can you put like a Thanos thing in there? But it does kind of come out of nowhere. It does feel like that it's a noble effort. And it did surprise me that they didn't just play Thanos as another one of these villains that's just like, I'm here to destroy the universe. Try and stop me. That was kind of a pleasant surprise. It is kind of like, it is missing, I don't know, kind of like a, in so much as we've been building to this, we haven't been really been as equally concerned about laying the foundation as to why he's obsessed with the stones and why he's trying to get the stones and why everyone's kind of scared of him. He's just been like a boogeyman. And
And it is interesting, of course, to think because he essentially is introduced, he's introduced in other films, but he's essentially introduced already super powerful because he's got two stones. So why the heck were people so scared of him before? I understand why they're scared of him now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, yeah, I definitely feel like that is sort of the big failure in that I feel like I was neither scared nor moved by the villain who's supposed to have motivations that I can understand.
And then it's all the same stuff after that, because he has like these like main minions called the Black Order who are a bunch of nothings. It would have been more interesting if they had like sort of gone into the archives a bit and like, well, who have been kind of like side villains in these movies before that we could maybe bring back. But you know, they're just a bunch of, you know,
we're powerful.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It was like, we're under the command of Thanos and we're going to kill you.
Well, so they're the children of Thanos. So I think we're supposed to believe, much like Gamora,
and
that he just picks people up and trains them. I mean, he's a bit of a cult leader himself, isn't he? The cult of Thanos.
Full circle. Amazing. Yeah. And then, at the end, it's another big fight against CGI Glee Globs. Ugh. And it's, you know, it doesn't come for much. Yeah. Versus what they could have done, which is in the comic book, which is Thanos, if I remember correctly, Thanos faces the heroes, but he doesn't use the gauntlet when he's fighting them, because he's trying to prove like he is all powerful even without the gauntlet, and he does manage to beat them all. Although it does pay tribute to that somewhat when he fights Captain America, and Captain America kind of
is the only one who has a little bit of
which I enjoyed that, because I enjoyed like when it shows like Captain America as like a man with like sheer power of will and determination and grit, and he will take on everybody. I can take this all day. That kind of ideal. It just would have been so much more interesting. It's just like, okay, Thanos is here. It would have been so much more, I think, impactful. Then just having another Gleep Glob fight, and it's all sort of predicated on what I think is like a plot hole, which is like you can't destroy the stones, but then their plan is to get this one stone and destroy it so we can't get all six.
Yeah, I don't understand why. First of all, Scarlet Witch, you know, what are her powers? She's weird. Right? Like, we've never really understood what her powers are in the movies.
Right.
And so she's the only person powerful enough to destroy this stone. So if she's powerful enough to destroy one stone, isn't she powerful enough to just basically, like, take care of this whole problem?
That was something I found very problematic, was the whole Vision-Scarlet Witch relationship, which I get is a thing from the comics. And I understand that they've been trying to build it up, but it just seemed like kind of like there were a lot of things that like just kind of don't get paid off in this. Like there's Bruce Banner has a thing where he can't summon the Hulk because
I have a whole problem. Like the most disappointing part of this film to me is Bruce Banner. I love the Hulk. He's probably my favorite superhero. I really like Bruce Banner. I love the whole thing, you know, as a person who, as I was when I was younger, I had some emotional regulation issues. Anger was definitely a thing. I have always really enjoyed the Bruce Banner, Incredible Hulk sort of thing, right?
And people thought you just liked green.
Yeah. So I have always really, really liked this. And I think I'm one of the three people who really liked Ang Lee's Hulk.
Oh, I liked it too.
Yeah, because I think there were definitely problems with it, but I think that Ang Lee really got Bruce Banner right.
Yeah.
Maybe Eric Bana didn't get Bruce Banner right.
But the script got it.
Yeah, yeah, right? Like, he's this person who he's got problems and he doesn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
So I really liked that. I was excited when Mark Ruffalo was cast. I think he did a great job as Bruce Banner in the past. And in this, he's just played up for laughs, which is really, really frustrating. It's so funny, impotent men. Like, I find it, it's just, I don't know. I could go on forever, but I found it not funny. I found the whole treatment of Bruce Banner as the comedic relief. Like, really, Bruce Banner, of all of those characters, he's the comedic relief in this movie.
It's a bit more blatant. I think he's always been kind of comedic. I think Whedon certainly treated him as having there's a kind of comedy to this idea of this man whose anger is so powerful he turns into a monster.
But it was a different type of comedy. You know, the comedy was a little bit of his, like,
it was dry.
Yeah.
That, like, the scene where he comes into the middle of the alien invasion, like, well, this seems horrible. I love that line. But, it is missing that. So there was the Hulk thing. There's the fact that everything that happened in Civil War is just kind of shoved into a corner. It's like, hey, you've got aliens. It's like, okay, you're under arrest because your superhero's doing superhero things. It's like, no, we're not. We're going to save the day. Okay, whatever. That kind of undermines the whole thing with that movie, which, despite its issues, is actually predicated on a very personal struggle. And the climax of Civil War, I find, is very powerful because it's, again, it's two guys fighting. It's not about Gleep Globs. And then, the Scarlet Witch and Vision stuff. It's really kind of easy to find things that there's inconsistency with the power of the stones and things. And
I also think we missed an amazing opportunity in this film to permanently kill off some characters.
Yeah.
Primarily Tony Stark as Iron Man, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's really time for that character to go.
Yeah.
There's no more story arc except for him to finally, as he keeps trying to do, but to finally actually give his life to save something.
Yeah, because the bit with Pepper Potts in it I found super annoying. Maybe it's because of Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't know.
Our feelings about Gwyneth Paltrow really changed over the last 10 years, haven't they?
But she's like playing a character that I can't stand, which is like the policeman's wife. You know, if you watch like a lot of cop shows or like there's always the wife who's like, I can't stand all these hours you work and, you know, you work too hard. And it's like, I'm waiting here at home with this pot roast on the table very dramatically and what have you. And it's just like they've kind of poured all that into Pepper Potts, which I can't, like, there was some sign of maybe they had gotten over that with in when she was popped up in Spider-Man Homecoming. That, you know, maybe she found some peace with Tony being Iron Man, but now we go right back to it in the beginning of this. But to go back to what you said, yes, I did like the different team-ups. I thought the camaraderie between all the characters was great.
Yeah.
Like watching Tony Stark and Doctor Strange have an arrogant off.
I love it because, like, there are no two more,
They're pompous, just, like, super arrogant with each other. It is great. You know, having Tom Holland there, well, it's constantly like, you remember this old movie? And it's like something from 30 years ago.
And then Peter Quill's like, yes, that one.
Yeah.
It's great.
And the bonding over Kevin Bacon with the Guardians.
Yeah. And I did really like that there was so much Guardians of the Galaxy, because I have made it clear in the past too, that Guardians really is right now, to me, the superhero team up I continue to watch, because it's just so different.
Yeah.
So it's refreshing.
Yeah, I was glad that they were kind of more integrated, and it wasn't just, hi, we're the Guardians. Here's some information for you. Gotta go. Bye. Mm-hmm. That would have been lame, and that there was kind of more of a team up afoot. I do like the ending. I do like the implications for the ending, because it implies that we're going to get something very scaled down for part four. Mm-hmm. Although I don't think we've seen anything about what part four is going to entail.
Yeah.
Maybe it's going to address these things. Like, we've gotten this huge thing up front, and maybe in this next one, it is going to be more personal. There's going to be more character moments, more opportunities for character interaction. Peter Dinklage cameo, I thought was
like
amazing.
The biggest person ever.
I thought that was the perfect
thing
for Peter Dinklage, because there was a character in the original Infinity Gauntlet story who was basically a troll, and I thought, oh, are they really going to make Peter Dinklage a troll? And it's like, no, they made him a big sort of alien blacksmith, and it was great when he appeared. I laughed. It was awesome. Also, it was in the midst of a team up with Thor, Rocket Raccoon, and Groot, which was great. I don't know who had that idea, like, let's send Thor off with Rocket Raccoon and Groot. But I think that is almost
that was a pretty good team up there.
They should make just like a movie about that. That should be one of the next movies, is Thor, Groot, and Rocket Raccoon. Call it the Three Musketeers or something. That's a terrible name, but that's something I just came up with on the fly.
And that Thor understands Groot language.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I am kind of glad we've gotten here now. It feels like, as we were saying, that Marvel is even at a place now where it's like, okay, we've done what we set out to achieve, which was to make this big interconnected universe. And my hope is going forward, because we, like, aside from a couple of movies, there's Captain Marvel coming out, another Avengers, another Spider-Man, and
another Black Panther.
Yes, there will definitely be another Black Panther. Yeah. And then we have Ant-Man and the Wasp as well.
Technically Deadpool, though it's not quite.
We'll see what happens, because that's a whole real life thing with Fox and Disney merging.
Yeah.
And actually, Fox, speaking of the National Theater Association, Fox kind of had like a eulogy for itself, because it might be like the last time they're there as a separate studio. Yeah. So they kind of had like this
in memoriam.
That's a bit of inside baseball, but we'll see what happens. We'll leave it there.
Yeah, so Avengers Infinity War, not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Well, that sounds like a quote ready to be ripped for the movie poster. You can listen to this episode and all our episodes at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also find us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Candace, Where can people find more of your work on the internet?
Well, you can find me everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8, and our new episode of the Village Podcast from the Bookshelf just came out this week, so please do go check that out as well.
A new episode of the Bookshelf podcast, you say?
Yep, sure did.
Cool. There will be an episode of a new episode of there will be a new episode of Open Source as well. Got to get myself straight here. New episode of Open Source Squelf tomorrow at 5 p.m. with me and Scotty Hertz. And you can listen to that here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And credits will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for something more low-key that won't involve at least 50 superheroes. And then we'll see you then. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.